Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Katie Meyer in for Scott Lamar. Today, we're talking about the midterm election we just had, specifically what it meant for the State House and Senate, which saw both Democrats pick up numbers we haven't seen in a while. And then later in the show, we'll also discuss some of the redistricting changes this election brought around the country and what that means for Pennsylvania. We welcome your questions and comments. Call us at 1-800-729-7532, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org, or leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page or Twitter. With me to start off the show are two longtime Harrisburg reporters, Mark Levy of the Associated Press and Charlie Thompson of Penn Live. Thanks for coming on, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So to start off, we know nationally Democrats took back the U.S. House. Governor Tom Wolf and U.S. Senator Bob Casey in Pennsylvania kept their seats. But in the State House and Senate, what can you guys tell us about what happened? Charlie?
Well, the Democrats picked up seats and really a substantial number of seats. I feel like this was the first election cycle in quite a while that the Democratic Party really got some traction at the State House and State Senate level. You know, they had been kind of really stuck or falling back for a long time. And they had been, you know, had these historically large Republican majorities in the House and the Senate. This time, call it the blue wave or whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
But the Democrats actually did get some traction and they picked up, I think we know, 11 seats net in the House and 5 seats in the Senate. So
exactly. Yeah. There's still a couple that are under some contention, but it's at least 11 and 5.
So, in the Senate, we started from a standpoint where the Republicans had a supermajority, literally, of 34 to 16, and that looks like that's going to be down to like 29 to 21, mm-hmm. and the House is going to be somewhere in the range of like 110 to 93. There will be a couple vacancies right off the bat because one of the members had died right before the election.
And he was still on the ballot.
And
I think that's a good place to, that's a good synopsis of it because we still have Democrats in the majority, in the minority rather.
Right.
And they're relatively significant minorities still, but they have picked up some seats. So, Mark, can you, because we haven't seen numbers this high for Democrats in a little while, does this mean anything for how effective they can be in state capital?
Well, it's a good question. It's hard to tell whether it'll make a substantial difference in how Republicans run their majorities and the types of bills that they're going to move. There's different ways of looking at it, that the Republican caucuses will become more conservative and less moderate now that they've seen a lot of their moderates from the southeastern Pennsylvania, Philadelphia suburbs defeated.
Sure.
And then there's, people who say, it could make them more willing to compromise now that their majorities are smaller. But the vast majority of, I think all the seats that flipped, there is a Senate seat in western Pennsylvania that looks like it's going to go to the Democrats. But otherwise, just about everything that flipped was in southeastern Pennsylvania, where Republicans traditionally are more moderate. And with fewer moderates in their caucuses, it'll be they'll be a little bit more to the right, and they'll have smaller majorities. But they'll still have, by and large, the same priorities that we've seen.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And now to get a little bit more granular on what may happen, we've got two state representatives on the line from our listening area, actually. Democrat Patty Kim of Dauphin County and Republican Greg Rothman of Cumberland County are both here. Welcome, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, representatives, actually, Patty, we'll start with you. In your time in the House, are there any initiatives that you can think of that you think may have been more successful with just a handful more Democratic votes?
Sure. I would put out just the May the Marcellus tax, implementing one of those kind of taxes.
So a severance tax on natural gas drilling that you guys, attempted several times and often was kind of defeated in procedural votes, right?
Yes.
Yes.
But with the moderates, some of the Republican moderates who were actually sponsoring the bill, you know, we'll see where that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Selfishly, I would like to see the minimum wage bill try again. This I will definitely try again in January. I know that a lot of the new members campaigned on that with mm-hmm. a higher minimum tax, a minimum wage tax, wage rather.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that we could get that through next session.
Sure. And do you see the minimum wage being something that may become a little bit more bipartisan? I know, for instance, Scott Wagner, former state senator who was just running for governor, even he had supported a moderate increase to the minimum wage.
Yeah, so we have to figure out what the magic wage is. I think a lot of people, the majority, are in support of a higher minimum wage. I mean, if Arkansas can do it, you know, Pennsylvania should be able to do it too. But I think finding that number where we can get a majority is what I'm trying to get for in January or next session.
Sure. And you guys still, I mean, Democrats still being in the minority, that you do need some Republican votes in order to get anything across the finish line. So, Greg, I want to go to you now. You and Patty worked together on a successful bill recently to get the city of Harrisburg special taxing authority. You know, as a Republican, a member of the majority, do you think the changes to the delegation are going to impact this sort of bipartisan work?
Well, what I'm hopeful about is that, you know, you have, I don't know, 25, 30 new members are coming in, and those members are coming in, you know, hopeful and optimistic and wanting to do positive things for the Commonwealth. And so, I mean, I think that's always an opportunity. You know, you don't have entrenched is the wrong words, but you don't have people who, I think they're optimistic. Excuse me, and being optimistic is, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I think Mark Levy, you had mentioned that we did see a lot of moderate Republicans lose their elections, primarily in the Southeast. And these were people who, you know, Representative Kim, you mentioned the Marcellus Shale tax. These were Republicans who had supported a tax on natural gas drilling. Greg, I'll ask this to you. Do you think that, the fact that these moderate Republicans are no longer in your delegation, do you think that makes the Republican delegation more conservative?
I think it's less likely we're going to do a Marcellus Shale tax, since you don't have bipartisan support. You only have Democrats pushing it. If, you know, the 10 of the Southeast members who are pushing a severance tax had lost their elections. But also, I mean, don't forget that the Democratic House members lost too, and their moderates, Acostas and mm-hmm. Brian Barbin, and even Mike Hanna Jr., you know, they were running as pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, more conservative blue dog Democrats. They lost too. So I think the Democratic caucus has moved further to the left, and which will present some challenges too. But I don't see the severance tax happening unless it's something where we're going to change the name of the impact fee to severance tax. So, or get rid of the impact fee in exchange for the severance tax. But I see that much less likely.
Mm-hmm. The impact.
Katie,
go ahead.
Wanted to interject and say that just looking from afar and talking to some of the older generation legislators, you know, deals were made in the past. And I think that was, you know, the oil. We always talk about the oil, you know, helping the engine move faster. And I came in as a reformer. There's a lot of new reformers coming in. The Republicans had a good number of theirs. And I think that, you know, other than, bipartisanship, you know, we all want that and we're all working towards that. But people going reforms, you know, deals are a bad word for the new members. And it's not a bad thing, but I think it slows things down a lot. And I'm sure Charlie has a good sense of what I'm talking about in terms of the old days and today. The representatives are just so different now, which is a good thing. We need to have transparency and I think it slows down the process in terms of how we operated a decade ago.
You're saying that you don't see as many deals happening across the aisle now as maybe we once did?
Yes.
Yes.
And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, you know, that, but I just think less things are being done because people are just like standing, you know, I'm here, this is what I believe, and I'm not going to go closer to you.
It'll also be interesting. You know, we lost some people who get stuff done, you know, like a Ron Marsico from Dauphin County or a Bill sorry, John Taylor from Philadelphia. I mean, some of the older legislators were good at getting stuff done. And I think though a lot of that has to do with the personal relationships you develop. And I mean, I want to, you know, give kudos to Representative Kim for helping get the Act 47 relief done, because you know that took a lot of effort. And I think maybe we set an example for other legislators that find things you can do to help the Commonwealth and work together on. And so I'm optimistic, but I'm sort of always optimistic.
Uh-huh. And Representative Kim, well, first I'll say I don't think it's a controversial thing to say that the Republican delegation in the House of Representatives, the state house, has moved to the right over the last decade or so. Now, Representative Kim, we've seen several Democrats elected to your delegation that are endorsed by the Democratic Socialists. There were two in the Pittsburgh area, I believe one in Philadelphia. Is that perhaps the direction that you're seeing as maybe less amenable to across the aisle deals?
I think it really matters on, you know, what topic we're talking about.
Sure.
You know, if it's reform, I think we can definitely get to 102. So I really think it, you know, it depends on the subject, really. And then there's a time where we have to all get acclimated and there's going to be a learning period, but I don't see anything drastic happening, you know, January 1st.
Mm-hmm. Don't see anything drastic happening. And then before I let you go, we've got about 2 minutes left here. I want to ask both of you, you know, we're going to see changes to party leadership. We're going to obviously see changes to the makeup of the delegations. Do you see major changes happening in how Harrisburg operates, or do you think this is going to be a similar thing to what we're used to when we start up this next session in January?
Greg,
We elected a large number of women, new women legislators. That, you know, Barb Glein from Carlisle, who's going to be outstanding. And Cumberland County's delegation now is, including the Senate, is now 50% women. But I heard a statistic the other day, and Patty can fill us in, that the Democrats don't have any minority chairmen who will be women because of seniority. So, you know, I don't know if the Democratic caucus is going to change their seniority rules, but I'm hoping that, you know, maybe the Republicans look at changing seniority and start to get more women in leadership.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kim, anything
else? Yeah, so we're right in the midst of it. You know, November 13th on Tuesday, we'll have our elections in-house. And I see a lot of women running and of color. So mm-hmm. I'm excited that I think our leadership will look different. And I think that's what voters want. You know, we had a lot of first-time millennials voting this election. Dauphin County is touting that we had a 60% voter turnout. So I want that excitement and this momentum to be reflective of, you know, new leadership, new faces, so that we can push towards, you know, a majority one day.
All right. Representative Patty Kim and Representative Greg Rothman, thank you guys so much. We're going to go to a break. You are listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Katie Meyer. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I'm Katie Meyer, and we are talking with Mark Levy of the Associated Press and Charlie Thompson of Penn Live. We are discussing the House and Senate state legislative elections and what the changes to our delegation, more Democrats were elected, are going to mean for the coming session. So, Mark, I want to start with you. Are there any topics that you're going to be watching now that Democrats aren't in quite so big of a hole?
Yeah, I mean, look, it didn't feel like anyway that there were any big topics that were left hanging at the end of this legislative session other than a fight over lifting statute of limitations in child sexual abuse cases. This mm-hmm. is legislation that's been inspired by the various Catholic Church scandals, as well as probably fueled a bit by the Sandusky scandal at Penn State. So, there's that. There's the perennial property tax debate, eliminating property taxes. Tom Wolf had a plan in 2015. Republicans have countered with their own plans, and the whole thing has sort of stalled. But the debate around school funding inequities hasn't
really stalled. It is still there. It is still being talked about. It's not clear that there's a way forward to some sort of compromise. But and of course, you know, both caucuses will have their priorities that they will advance, whether for the Republicans, it's things like work requirements for Medicaid or punishing sanctuary cities, and for Democrats and Tom Wolf, imposing a severance tax on the Marcellus Shale and and perhaps minimum wage, as Patty Kim mentioned.
Yeah, so kind of a slate of issues that we've been seeing before. But I want to start off with that sex abuse bill, because that was really the last big thing we covered. I think you and I were both at the Capitol very, very late on their final session day trying to see what they would do, and the answer to that was nothing. When that bill broke down, and this was, you know, again, one of the most high-profile things the state legislature was working with, when it broke down, we were hearing rumors that there were a number of Senate Republicans who didn't want to vote for the version of the bill that the Senate was going to put up. Two of those Republicans, at least two of the Republicans who I know were on the fence about it, were they lost their reelection campaigns. That was John Rafferty and who else? It was
and Tom McGarrigle of Delaware County.
Tom McGarrigle and possibly Tommy Tomlinson, who is still kind of counting votes. So, you know, Charlie, I'll ask you, I mean, do you think that, you know, the change to the Senate delegation, because just to recap this issue, Senate President Pro Tem Joe Scarnati has been reluctant to create a window where the, you know, statute of limitations would apply to old cases, the reduced statute of limitations. So you'd be able to, like, bring suits on old cases. Do you think that the changes to the delegation are going to impact that?
You know, I really can't say with any certainty, but
sure.
I've been kicking that around in my own mind, too, and I was thinking about it. I think I come at it just as the way you kind of led into the question, that Rafferty was the one guy, Senator John Rafferty from Montgomery County, Philly suburbs, was the one Senate Republican who had publicly broken with his caucus leaders and said that he wanted to see the two-year retroactive window. And, you know, he's gone now. And I just think it may be easier. Part of me wants to think that it might be easier for Scarnati to kind of continue to have the support of his caucus on his position, which is, well, we'll set up victims' compensation funds and create this mediation process, but we're not going to open the door back into the courthouse for people who have whose cases have hit the statutory deadlines. But I can't say that with certainty. I mean, I guess you kind of have to know. We have to kind of get into the session and see. But I guess I'm starting to think that maybe Scarnati's hand has been bolstered a little bit on that, but sort of something you have to wait and see on, I guess.
For sure. Yeah, we don't want to speculate.
Because the one thing about it is the other side's not going away. They're going to demand that window, and they're very passionate, and they really believe in what they're arguing for there. And, you know, I mean, Scarnati felt like he had met them more than halfway by agreeing to eliminate the statute of limitations on all child sex abuse crimes going forward and creating victims' compensation funds. But the window is where things are stuck. And interestingly enough, as a side note, I mean, I see that the dioceses across the state are actually, you know, fully moving forward with their victims' compensation funds now. So I don't know how that changes the flavor of that debate, too.
Right, absolutely. We have a question from a caller who could not stay on the line, but they ask something I think is interesting. One of the big issues of the current session is the animosity between the House Republican leadership and the Senate Republican leadership. Did the election have any impact on that dynamic? Mark, what do you think?
We're talking in the State House, right?
In the State House.
No, I fully expect that Republican leadership will remain largely intact in the House. Dave Reed, the majority leader, is retiring. He decided not to run again for his seat.
He was seen as a relative moderate in comparison, especially to his fellow leader, Mike Terzai, the House Speaker.
And I expect that Brian Cutler, the whip from Lancaster County, will succeed Dave Reed as majority leader in the Senate. I fully expect that leadership there will return. That would be Joe Scarnati, as Charlie mentioned, the president pro tem. Jake Corman is the majority leader. And to the extent that there's hostility between them, you know, there's always raw feelings in that building after a session comes to a close and there's a deadline and there's a big fight at the end of it. And sometimes those raw feelings are heal up a little bit in periods of the legislative session. But, you know, in large part, there's always fights. There's mm-hmm. always fights between leadership, between governors and top lawmakers, and there's always hard feelings that come and go. And, you know, the extent to which it prevents things from getting done is hard to tell from the outside looking in.
Yeah. I want to talk about abortion. This is an issue in Pennsylvania that I think a lot of people, when they come into it, think, okay, it's probably going to be a partisan thing. Republicans want to, you know, maybe narrow windows for abortion or make them a little bit harder to get or not fund them with state dollars. And Democrats are against that. But in Pennsylvania, there is a lot of, you know, line crossing party-wise on this issue. Charlie, you've covered many abortion-related initiatives over the years. Do you see there being significant changes that would impact how these bills fare in the State House and Senate?
And no, because the reason is because Governor Wolf is reelected and he's, you know, he's really solid in his position.
And I think we know vetoed that, any abortion.
Yeah,
bill.
I think we know that if there are any attempts to restrict a woman's right to have an abortion, that Governor Wolf is where he is, and he's right. kind of an immovable object on that.
Yeah,
I mean. They're going to, you know, I think the leaders trying to be in tune with their members, the Republican leadership, know that they have, you know, a conservative membership that wants to deliver action to the their base voters on that issue. And so we'll probably see the bills come up again, but it's just hard for me to see how... You know, that really changes. I think they get passed. We might see it get past the legislature again and hit the governor's desk, and the governor does the same thing he did in the last session, mm-hmm. veto.
Yep.
And they don't have enough to override the veto.
No, absolutely. One of the things I did note in this sort of new session is that a couple of top Democrats who did support, you know, bills to restrict abortions have now retired. Joe Marcosic, who had been the House Appropriations Minority Chair, and Mike Hanna, whose seat his son ran for and was taken by a Republican. Mm-hmm. I think both of those guys were pretty socially moderate Democrats,
yeah.
And so they're out of the picture. So maybe the Democratic caucus is moving a little bit left on issues like this.
Yeah, and I know you can't, you know, it's maybe not a straight from point A to point B on this, but one other aspect of that, do you realize that we will have a record number of women serving in the Pennsylvania General Assembly this year? And you know, I don't know how that shapes that debate, but because, you know, certainly some of the people who have proposed the abortion restrictions in the past are Senator Michelle Brooks, Representative Kathy Rapp. I mean, there are certainly women who are anti-abortion, and so, you know, people aren't monolithic on that by gender.
Sure.
But the point is, there will be a healthy number of more new women.
Yeah.
That number is going up to 63.
Yeah, wherever they stand, you're going to have more women weighing in on this issue.
Right.
And potentially in, you know, the Democratic caucus, more women in leadership, because we've never had women in real leadership positions in our General Assembly pretty much ever. We've had a couple of whips
Patty,
who were women.
Yeah, Patty Kim referenced that. I mean, I'm very excited to see if that comes about. I don't know if it will come about this session, but I haven't really familiarized myself with who's tossed their hat in the ring for those leadership races. But you know, I think that would be a really good thing for the Pennsylvania General Assembly to diversify the ranks that way in top leadership positions.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been women in the sort of the junior grade leadership positions, but haven't seen it in appropriations chairmanships. Haven't seen it in floor leaders, certainly not the speaker or the president pro tem.
Mm-hmm.
So
Yeah, so that could be some changes. I want to ask, too, about labor issues. When I talked to, just in preparation for this episode, talked to some Senate leaders and some House leaders from the Democratic caucuses, they both mentioned that things that they may have more success on are labor-related issues. Now, Patty Kim mentioned the minimum wage, where we may see a little bit more strength on the Democratic side on that, maybe enough to pass something. Are there any other, you know, labor things that you're looking at, Mark, that may change?
I mean, I'd have to think that through for a second, but let me start by saying this, that generally the Republican majorities will not bring a bill to the floor unless it has at least majority support within their caucus. Mm-hmm. And so to the extent that there's going to be a minimum wage bill getting to the floor, it would have to have majority support in a Republican caucus. And the reason why a minimum wage bill hasn't been getting to the floor, presumably, is because it just doesn't have that critical level of support within the Republican caucus. And that's, you know, part of how you manage your majority and how you get reelected as speaker or majority leader or president pro tem or whip, is that you only bring bills that the majority of your caucus is willing to support and to allow a vote on the floor. And I don't see where a minimum wage bill has that kind of support in the Republican caucus. There's other labor-related issues that, say, anti-labor union, you know, bills that may have a tougher time getting through the chambers now with smaller Republican majorities. But
I always wonder if there might be room for a grand compromise on that, though.
A grand compromise.
Yeah. And, like, for example, I wonder about these moving parts. Like, one thing that the Republicans have badly wanted the last couple sessions is to put work requirements on if you want to get medical assistance, you would have to take a job, work 20 hours a week, or show that you're in a job training program,
right,
or a schooling to get ready for a job training program. And they've badly wanted that, and Governor Wolf has vetoed that, and you know the Democrats want this minimum wage, and I wonder if that could be like an area of a grand compromise. Like we'll allow the minimum wage to float up to a certain level if you give us these work requirements. I mean, it seems like the kind of issue that they could both work around and get to. But anyway. Yeah. That's just my thinking.
Yeah. For the record, on this, Pennsylvania is in our general area and increasingly across the country an outlier when it comes to the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. We still are in the federal minimum wage, which is what, $7.50, $7.25.
Yeah.
And all the states that surround us are now higher.
One other labor issue that this is really sort of a labor and social issue, I guess, but it has labor implications. The General Assembly is a little bit out of step with public opinion, and a little more so all the time on the issue of...
all the time, generally.
Well, I'm just saying, on the issue of anti-discrimination protections for...
Yes, that's a good point.
...gay, lesbian, transsexual folks.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to wonder if there's going to come a point where... I, that's one thing where I look at, like, all these new members coming in... and more women, you have to wonder if that might tilt the balance. And as you said, some of those more conservative Democrats leaving. I wonder when that balance is going to change, that the General Assembly will actually catch up with where public opinion is and where the courts have already moved us in many phases of life on extending anti-discrimination protections sexual orientation.
That's an interesting proposition because Pennsylvania has already done that once. We did extend specifically hate crime protections for people based on sexual orientation.
Yes.
And then it was passed as part of a different bill that was not seen as related. So the Supreme Court threw it out.
And that would seem to be a layup, wouldn't it? That they already did it.
Exactly. Things change. And once one thing comes up, it's difficult to get it to come up again often in our General Assembly. I want to end on this. We have a couple more minutes, guys. Mark, our two guests earlier, the representatives, mentioned bipartisanship, how bipartisanship is going to work in the General Assembly with these different majorities, or with these different numbers, rather. we do see Republicans, I think, getting, you know, they've gotten more conservative over the years, and we just knocked off a lot of their moderates, or the Democrats did. And we've seen a couple more left-leaning Democrats supplanting moderate Democrats. Do you see these two caucuses just kind of going farther and farther apart?
I would expect that there will be fewer moderate voices now within the Republican caucus room, and so that will have an effect. On the other hand, they'll be over on the Democratic side pushing back on Republicans. Democrats, for years, really, at least the last 10, maybe 20 years, have been losing moderates from Western Pennsylvania. I mean, the shift has been when you look at how many seats they've lost west of the Susquehanna River, it is striking when you look back. So I think the Democratic caucus has probably long ago moved leftward.
Sure.
And now we'll see this dynamic in the Republican caucus, because the crucial thing that just happened in this election was that Democrats took the majority of seats in Philadelphia's suburbs,
yes,
in the Senate and the House.
That's
never happened before, or it's at least in the modern era, mm-hmm, when Republicans were able to keep getting reelected to these seats in increasingly moderate and liberal areas around Philadelphia. And the big complaint had been, you know, by Democrats, is that as long as labor unions were supporting Republicans, Republicans were going to keep winning these seats. Democrats couldn't knock them off. Well, now they have, mm-hmm, after trying for years and years and years, and now they have the majority of these seats there. And I expect there will be noticeable differences mm-hmm in the coming session that people will see.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Mark Levy of the AP and Charlie Thompson of Penn Live, thank you guys so much. You're listening to Smart Talk at WITF. For the record, our election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair. I'm Katie Meyer. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I'm Katie Meyer in for Scott Lamar. On Monday, we're recognizing Veterans Day, commemorated yesterday, the 11th day of the 11th month. 100 years ago Sunday, an armistice was signed ending World War I. Join us for a Smart Talk Veterans Day recognition with a discussion on World War I, the war to end all wars. And now back to this episode. This election, one of the other things that we saw, other than some changes in the State House and Senate and Congress, is four states around the country voted to change how they draw congressional and state legislative districts. Pennsylvania was not one of them, but our next guest is Fair District Pennsylvania's Carol Cunaholm, and she says it's still a pretty big deal for the Commonwealth. Carol, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, by the way, we welcome your questions and comments. Call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Again, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Carol, so which states now were you looking at as Pennsylvania, well, as the country went into these midterm elections?
We've certainly been watching Michigan. They had a great referendum movement on voters, not politicians. They collected hundreds of thousands of petition signatures to do that. We've been watching Missouri. They have a clean Missouri initiative, which included a provision for an independent demographer to draw their district maps, but lots of other provisions on clean money and ethics reforms. We've been watching Utah, and Colorado is interesting because the legislators in Colorado were the ones who initiated and compromised together to put together a bipartisan piece of legislation. So that's a great interest. We wish our legislators would do that.
And so, yeah, speaking of our legislators, let's recap what has happened with redistricting in our own General Assembly. We saw a proposal come up through the Senate to change how Pennsylvania redraws its congressional maps and its state legislative maps. That was going to have to be a constitutional amendment. And it would have had to pass this summer, but it did not. So you know, that's obviously, that was a big setback for, I think, people who wanted to redraw our congressional districts and our state legislative districts by 2021, which is the next time they will be redrawn. Do you see that as a setback, first of all? And how have you guys, your organization, have you kind of dealt with that?
Well, yeah, it was a disappointment. What was interesting, there were actually two bills. Senate Bill 22 was given hearings. It went through the amendment process in the Senate, and it actually got voted out of the Senate with an amendment that certainly people were not happy with. But it did actually get attention. It did actually get a vote in the House. There was a identical bill, House Bill 722, that had 110 co-sponsors. That's more than half of the House. And yet it was not even given a hearing. Mm-hmm. It was going to be discharged by the Representative Steve Samuelson, the prime sponsor. He attempted to move it out of the committee where it was stuck. And that committee chair, Daryl Metcalf, brought it up, introduced his own amendment, gave no time for discussion. The committee voted to accept his amendment, and then they didn't even vote it out of committee, so there was no way to alter it. So yes, it was a disappointment to watch all of this take place. It was also an incredible education for voters across the state to really step inside of our state house and watch the process. And you mentioned, your guest earlier talked about some ways that Pennsylvania is an outlier. What we've discovered is Pennsylvania is an outlier in a lot of ways. There are many electoral reforms that have been enacted across the country that have never been given a hearing or a vote in Pennsylvania. And we're an outlier in the way our state legislature works, that the leadership has so much control over what is heard and what is not heard. So we've been disappointed, we've been educated, and now we're going to take what we've learned and come back even stronger in the next session.
So with you guys coming back stronger, you mentioned these four successful efforts in other states to change how redistricting is done. You know, how does that affect Pennsylvania? Are you going to be able to use that to leverage our state legislature? Like, you know, if we couldn't get this done before, what does this change?
Well, I mean, one thing that's really interesting is only one of the states where they put these reforms forward is even on the list of the 10 worst gerrymandered states. Mm-hmm. So Colorado, Utah, Missouri, they don't even make it onto any measure that you use. They don't even make it onto the measure. Their citizens just say, we want to know our maps are drawn fairly, and going into the future, we want to have this in place. Mm-hmm. Michigan is the only one that comes close to Pennsylvania in terms of gerrymandering. So part of what's happened is citizens across the country, when we started in January 2016, we were warned, don't use the word gerrymandering because no one has a clue what it means. And now with the attention across the country, most people have some idea what gerrymandering means. They don't understand the inner workings of it, but most people know what it means, have an idea that this means voters are being cheated out of their vote. So we've been able to leverage that public attention. And then we want to sit down, look at those bills and see, are there things in here that we could take to our legislators and say, look, legislators in Colorado agreed to do this. Can you agree to do this? And also the thinking in Colorado very much was they have had both parties have the opportunity to gerrymander, harm the other, and they've had lots of lawsuits and lots of bitterness. And the legislators there agreed this is not a way to run a state, and we want to stop it. Mm-hmm. Together, they agreed on that. And we would say in Pennsylvania, we've seen lawsuits are not the solution. I mean, they certainly change things, as we saw in the change of our delegation to Congress. But in terms of helping voters feel confidence in the system or helping legislators do better in what they were elected to do, not the best way to go. We would much rather see a fair process in place for everyone so that when the numbers in the House and Senate change, which they will, or when the situation surrounding it changes, they don't have to be afraid that the other party is going to wreak revenge. Right now, if things stay as they are, the Democrats will have the upper hand in redrawing the legislative district lines next time around. And Republicans who are paying attention ought to want to fix this before that happens.
Now, you mentioned lawsuits if anybody's been paying attention to the redistricting, I guess, saga in Pennsylvania, you'll know that we did redraw our congressional maps via a Supreme Court decision this past year. And this was, again, the result of a lawsuit. The Supreme Court really created new criteria for these maps to be drawn and gave the state legislature some time to redraw it based on those. And then they took too long, according to the court, and the court redrew the maps. So there is, I think it can't be understated, an incredible amount of acrimony within the state House and Senate on this, specifically on the part of Republicans who felt like the new map benefited, was better for Democrats. And we did see our congressional delegation change. We now have 9 Republicans and 9 Democrats, which is obviously an increase in Democrats. Now, whether or not you know, you think that was fair on the part of the court, or that you think the map is good or bad. You're saying, Carol, that this is not obviously a solution. Obviously, you know, the map will change again. But do you see the fact that the Supreme Court did this? Do you think that helped or hurt the discussion in the state legislature on actually changing the law?
I would say that for voters, what they saw in this election is that maps matter, and they matter a lot. So the Democrats had in this election 52% of the vote share, and we've gone back through the number of years past since the 2011 congressional maps were drawn. I mean, part of the lawsuit was that over those years the districts were drawn so that there was no choice in any districts across the state. And so we had seen that, you know, they were drawn very specifically for those incumbents, and those incumbents stayed put, and voters across the state, wherever they were, felt like, I'm not being represented, and I really have no choice here. What we saw in this election across the state was a huge amount of energy and interest in the congressional races, because for the first time in a long time, people felt like, my vote is going to matter, and I'm going to go vote. And that's huge. I mean, for democracy, I would say it's a huge win to have people see that the system is meant for your vote to matter. So if one party gets 52% of the shares, they should get about 52% of the seats. In the past, even if Democrats had 55 or more percent of the vote, they still had exactly 5 seats out of 18. That's toxic to democracy. So we would say that was a huge win for voters, for the people of Pennsylvania. For the discussion of reform, it was a bit of a setback, because during the whole time the lawsuit was taking place, Republican legislators refused to talk to anybody about this issue. We think that was wrong. We think that was a misunderstanding of how the legal process works. But it certainly set the conversation back a bit. And as you said, there was a lot of acrimony, which was not helpful to trying to get this resolved. We hope that we can all set that aside and have some good conversation moving forward.
And, you know, now talking about setting that aside, let's go through what's actually, you know, possible in the next session or so ahead of the next redistricting. Now, redistricting happens 2020. There's not enough time to do any sort of constitutional amendment in the way that we thought there was before. But you don't necessarily need a constitutional amendment to redraw congressional maps, right? Just state House and Senate.
Right. Congressional maps can be done as a simple bill.
As a simple bill. Now, passing over for a second whether or not we can get that simple bill passed, you know, you do have sort of a theory about potentially trying to get the state House and Senate map redrawing process changed along with that?
Yeah, there is a possibility. So if you can put in place a commission to draw congressional district maps, putting the commission in place is a time-consuming process, we learned in conversation with others. If you're going to have a truly open, transparent selection process, it takes time. People need to be informed. They need to apply. They need to be vetted. And then they need to be trained. So that's a bit of a time-consuming process. Our concern was, if this is not in place before 2021, it really needs, the selection process needs to start before the data is given to the state from the federal government that they then use to redraw the lines after the census. The idea is if there's a congressional redistricting commission already in place by simple statute, and they're busily, you know, they're selected, they're trained, then a constitutional amendment, if it was passed in this session, could be passed very early in 2021, and then that commission could then be used to do the legislative districts as well. So that's an idea that we're exploring. We're hoping that we have some legislators who are interested in exploring that with us. Mm-hmm. We're looking forward to having that conversation. And at the same time, we want to say there are other safeguards that could be put in place. So even if we can't do that, even if it's too high a lift, we're certainly not going to back off on this issue, and we're certainly going to be continuing to build public interest in having a fair, transparent process.
And what are those other measures that you think would be effective, if not an actual, you know, law change?
So the Clean Missouri Act, they have a demographer draw it. We know that whoever says they're drawing the map, it's always a paid demographer who is drawing the map. But they're being given information, and they're being told to draw it in particular ways, and that's the piece that we don't know. So we don't know, you know, why districts are drawn quite the way they were, either for the maps drawn in 2011-12 or by the Supreme Court. So it would not be a particularly difficult thing in our legislation. Any legislation is a difficult thing, but we could see a bill passed that would require the process to be transparent, that would require whatever demographer did the work to disclose what data was used, that would forbid the use of partisan electoral data or voter registration data, or make it all transparent. We could also see a bill requiring that any division of counties or municipalities be explained. Or we could see a bill that would require public input before maps were proposed and then after maps are proposed. There's a number of ways to push the whole process out into the open. Right now it's in a back room, and five guys for the legislative districts, five guys sit in a back room and think about who they want to punish and who they want to protect. And nobody really knows how those decisions are made. And the congressional district map, the leadership somewhere sits somewhere and draws a map, and then they just hand it to the legislature and say, vote. And we know last time the legislature didn't even know what that map looked like. So we want to force the whole thing out into the open and make it transparent. And there's certainly ways to do that, even if we can't get an independent commission in place.
And then back to the independent commission, because that is, again, your ideal solution. You know, and again, I can't stress enough, this is a very difficult thing to get past. It is been proven in our state legislature. But, you know, our current process for, let's just say, congressional redistricting versus this. Carol, we just have a couple of minutes left. But for people who are trying to understand this issue, what are the fundamental differences between what we have now and what you guys want?
The idea would be to take away the conflict of interest. In other words, right now we have the people who benefit most from those electoral lines drawing the lines themselves. It's like allowing one team to supply the umpire and have that umpire be their team captain. It's just inappropriate. So the idea is to remove the conflict of interest, to have an independent commission made up of citizens from both parties and independent or third party, and to have a voting mechanism for those citizens where they, members from each group, have to agree on a map that's appropriate, and have it all be transparent and have public input. That's what we're proposing. If anybody wants to learn more, we have a website, fairdistrictspa.com, where they can read more. We're also having a town hall meeting in Harrisburg on December 1st, where we're going to be looking at redistricting reform, but also looking at why it is so very difficult to get any kind of reform passed in our state legislature.
Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to mention the town hall. So you guys are, you've been sort of quiet for the last, I would say, several months after the last redistricting effort sort of crashed and burned, but you're coming back basically in this new session. What are, other than getting stuff passed, what are the strategies here?
Part of it is just to help people to see what happens in Harrisburg, to understand what happens in Harrisburg, to see how bills move or don't move, and to build public awareness that our system is very broken. We are an outlier. And we are an outlier because of what happens in our state legislature, and we need to fix it.
All right. Carol Cuneholm with Fair Districts PA, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. And thanks to all of our guests for being part of our conversation today. If you missed any part of today's show, you can hear it again online at WITF.org/smarttalk. Smart Talk's also available as a podcast. You can listen when you're away from your radio using iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you find podcasts. And I should note, I also host a separate podcast on PA Post, and that podcast is also going to be this episode of Smart Talk this time around. So what we can do is just you can go to either PA Post or Smart Talk on WITF and listen to this episode there. Again, I'm Katie Meyer, and for Scott Lamar, thanks so much.